Welcome to Socialist Voices. Sorry for the lateness of this podcast. The SSP has been extremely busy over the past couple of weeks, what with our conference and the work now to be done on the various motions passed at that, and of course our demonstrations last Wednesday against the Tory Queen's speech. Today we woke up to the news that Charlie Kennedy, former leader of the Lib Dems, died at the far too young age of 55. Our condolences to his family. My personal feelings about Charlie are that he was a man of integrity in a party with a leadership of ambitious snakes. He shamed the ambitious and backstabbers who facilitated the Tories. I liked the Charlie I saw on TV. I never met the man, but from what all who did have said today, what you saw seems to have been what you got. That is, a man of integrity and obvious real humanity, unlike the people I met in his party, most of whom were right-wing, backstabbing and viciously ambitious. Let me also say this, and again this is my opinion, alcohol is a terrible drug. And those of us who've enjoyed it without realising it was a problem, and in fact who said, I enjoy it, it's doing no harm, are the hardest to convince. I enjoyed a drink or 10, quite a lot, for 30 years, and I've known people who died too young because of it. For me, stopping drinking while I was on top has been good. I wouldn't tell people to stop, but I would say this, look at who profits from your bad health, and it isn't you or those around you. I was really sorry to hear of Kennedy's death, and I have no doubt that alcohol dependence, self-medication, enjoyment of a drink, quickened his untimely demise. That's my 10 bob's worth. Anyway, on Socialist Voices this time, Matthew Geraghty on the Marionettes pageant, that was the Queen's speech, Sandra Webster, co-spokesperson for the party, on the SSP-led demos last Wednesday, co-spokesperson Colin Fox on what was the main news in the last week, the Scotland Bill, Dawn McKean on the continuing saga of unwanted liar Alistair Carmichael MP, Deborah Torrance sells vuvuzelas two for a pound, Michael Greenwell interviews SSP member and founder of Labour for Independence Alan Grogan, and Callum Martin on the Chartists. We have again, as always, brilliant music from this time from The Exiles, The Cundies, Joe Solo, Intero Bang, St Christopher's Medal, Milton Starr, The Faction, The Wakes, and Steve White and the Protest Family. Enjoy the podcast. These are The Exiles and From Nowhere to Nowhere.
If you're looking for somebody to blame. looking for somebody to blame, if you're looking for somebody to blame.
So the Queen gave her speech, which wasn't hers, and Dennis didn't skin her. Or even give voice to the quick quip with which the Beast of Bolsover usually full stops Blackrod's visit. Perhaps, capped fat and content, he was too busy taking idle swipes at passing SNPers from his personal perch, a fiefdom that, luck would have it, perfectly matches the dimensions of his posterior. And what is it about this marionette's pageant that makes me want to nail boiled eggs to my eyes? Maybe it's that mix of high camp and the sprawling drone of despair it's delivered in. Olivia, it's not. More akin to being repeatedly struck a violent blow to the back of their head, while each bill slowly bobs to the surface like a crouton in a fecal stew. And what bills there are! 3 million new apprenticeships. 3 million! But in what? Given the shriveled nature of our manufacturing industry, I can only imagine it's baristas and sandwich makers that will fill the yawning gap. And then there's the promise of a country of security and opportunity for all, at every stage of life. This last caveat being a nod to the fact that the future will hold no opportunity for retirement, and, should you stumble to your century, the monarch's letter will include a discount voucher for Dignitas. And let's face it, by then, a date with Dignitas will be a benefit worth claiming. Not, of course, that we'll have anyone on benefits. There'll be full employment, apparently. For the Employment and Welfare Benefits Bill is designed to provide more people with the security of a job, no doubt secure employment on zero-hour contracts, adding to the expanding mass of the UK's working poor and the stress of everyday life. However, there's no mention of addressing the accrued benefits the accident of birth confers. And just as this thought drops into the front of my mind, the camera sweeps across the faces of those who have known nothing but benefits. A face blistering close-up of George Osborne fills my screen, a man with all the charisma of a dishcloth and the complexion of uncooked lawn sausage. I would rather spend all eternity repeatedly chewing my own scrotum in some Groundhog Day revisited nightmare than spend 1 second of anyone's time with Georgie Boy. I wouldn't trust him to fix a cup of tea, never mind the deficit. And then that odious man of the people, One Nation Dave, hoves into view, looking for all the world like a spanked penis, and I feel violated. A wayward train of thought has me imagine him as a minor villain in a Chuck Norris film, a film in which Chuck administers justice by roundhouse kicking him in the face 37 million times. He looks like I imagine Barabbas looked when Jesus got the crucifix gig, unable to understand how he's still Prime Minister and not nailed to some post-election cross. Still, there's time. Yet the more the speech unravels, the more I'm struck by the fact that this government seems determined to eradicate sympathy and compassion from society. Those qualities that mark us apart from nature red in tooth and claw, replacing it with hate. Hate of those on benefits, hate of foreigners, hate of the unions, hate of privacy, hate of radicals and, by default, hate of democracy. An uncomfortable truth. And speaking of hate, do you hate your job? Find yourself weeping your way through Monday? Entertain idle thoughts about self-destruction? Then imagine being the Queen. A life lived polishing the country's silver, while boredom slowly chews her face off. I mean, what is a queen for? I mean, we see her totter on screen, held together by pomp and circumstance, then deliver the words of someone else's dream, and all in a voice that would grate upon the dead. Is she just some ancient artefact, a fossilised gesture worn smooth by time, visible yet without meaning or content? There is, in truth, no creature so lonely as an old queen, nor monarch of any age or sex. Look into their face and you will find neither happiness nor sorrow, only emptiness. For they are not even the shell of a person, merely the structure. Born into a yesterday that has no value today, they are the echo of a time long since dead and gone. Hers is puppet life. The empress of nothing, the cat's paw of every government, the acceptable face of Britain and the myth of Britannia. And, like Bagpuss, she awaits animation. Times when she is thrust into the light with the government's metaphorical hand rammed deep inside. Times when she takes on the role of the ventriloquist dummy. I dream of the day her madge finally snaps, tears her robes from her back, cracks Blackrod in the face with his stick, and chases the government from the chamber whilst howling like a banshee. For let's face it, Any dream is better than the poker-faced reality of a speech that leaves you feeling like the victim of a particularly vicious baseball attack.
I thought we'd be there. We're not home yet. We only talk now. Driving the car. I got a little crazy. I got a little dizzy. Both got busy. Drive off the road, dear. Don't feel the same. Face in the rear view. I guess I lost sight of you. And the kids are in the back, fast asleep like they still really are. The wheel, my love, steer us back. Can you steer us back?
That was the Brilliance and Christopher's Medal and From As a Fear of Comfort. Indie Livestream, a citizens' media organisation, are training ordinary people to live stream events via their phone and tablets. They have an event on Tuesday the 2nd of June and Thursday the 4th of June in the Counting House in Glasgow at 7 o'clock in the evening. Please, if you're wanting to get the voices of independents, including ours, onto the net and into the alternative media we have now become reliant on, please go along and learn how to do the simple yet effective form of social media. They also have a crowdfunder on their website. Please go to it and give what you can to this essential service. Equipment, transport and running costs need to be met, and many of these people fork out their own money to get alternative views from the mainstream out to us. Their website is www.independencelive.net. The revolution will be live streamed, comrades, the Smilton Star and Things Fall Apart.
last Wednesday, Renfrewshire SSP took part in an action to campaign against the legislation that would be announced by wee Betty as she read her government speech. This is written on the finest vellum made from poor pigs or calves and pulled from a silken purse. SSP campaigners were joined by friends and supporters from all over Scotland, from Arbroath in the north-east to Ayrshire in the west, and most places in between. In Paisley, we had chosen to protest outside Lady Annabel Goldie's office. Her full title, actually, is Lady Annabel Goldie of Bishopton in the County of Renfrewshire. Her office is in Shuttle Street in Paisley. She's a lucky woman. As well as sitting as an MSP, she has a seat in the House of Lords, two jobs for the price of one. It was very difficult to find her office. Of course, we knew where Shuttle Street was. It's a very important part of Paisley. But when we arrived at Shuttle Street, there wasn't even a name plaque on the wall to see where 10 Shuttle Street was. But anyway, we rang the neighbours and they told us that there was nobody there. So that wasn't surprising. We knew where they were. So we sang some songs and persuaded some passerby to join us. We were loud and proud and minded that so many of our comrades we're doing the same thing all around Scotland. And it's that spirit of solidarity we're going to need in the next 5 years of Tory misrule. Another thing I was mindful of during that wee protest is that we are a part of a strong tradition of protesting. Paisley might seem today as a town down on its luck, a high street full of imaginary shops. To disguise the shops that closed a decade ago, the council put signs up in empty buildings with posters saying, imagine a toy shop, imagine a post office, imagine a fruit shop. These things aren't part of our high street. It didn't fool anybody, and we moaned and called them a Pushkin village. Now, Paisley has a forgotten history of radicalism. At the very start, when the working class were beginning to get organised, the Paisley Weavers were at the very heart of it. When meetings were banned, redcoats fought with protesters down Paisley High Street. They went right past Annabel Goldie's office in Shuttle Street. That's what happened. You've probably heard of Baird, Hardy and Wilson. They're famous socialists. The SNP claim them as their own and their famous sign in Scotland's Fever Desert. But they were socialists and they believed in home rule. When they were arrested in Paisley, there were riots. People trying to stop them being transferred to Greenock. What happened in Greenock is that people released them from the jail. And that's real people power. Today, we have Smash Hot Day, a working class holiday. When children bathe to burn the cork, which is the effigy of a capitalist. That's the highlight of the day, when that is burned. Then we return to our ice creams and forget all about our radical history. Our history is important, protesting is important, so has been radical. I'll tell you the next time about Smash Hot Day and the history involving that. Until next time, let's educate, agitate and organise folk. Take care. Bye.
Thanks, Sandra. Coming up, a brilliant event for your diary. I was over the moon to find out that SSP Motherwell and Wishaw branch had organised a fundraiser with the Wakes and with the band La Flair in the Davy Cooper Suite in Fir Park, Motherwell. Doors open 6 o'clock on Saturday the 6th, and for the tiny sum of £3 you will not only see the Champions League final, but two of Scotland's best bands. £3, the price of a cappuccino, and cheaper than Harper's Bazaar magazine. These are the Wakes, and this is Colours.
Are green, the colours are blue. When you're born in this world, they give the colours to you. You don't have a choice. In a city that's shaped by the scars of the past, our colours are taken, nailed to the mast. Hear the songs of the tribes. Some call it the holy war, a subdivision to cut the city to the core. Another Derby Day, another casualty, and all the paper says just another Saturday. Colours are green, the colours are blue. When you're born in this world, they give the colours to you. You don't have a choice. Teenage boys, too young to remember it, but old enough to die. And the paper said, wrong place, wrong time. This is our city and these are our colours. This is our city and these are our colours. This is our city and these are our colours. This is our city and these are our colours. This is our city and these are our colours. Find your drum, you're up to your knees in hate.
Big political development this week in Scottish politics has undoubtedly been the Queen's speech and the details in the Scotland Bill announced by David Cameron. Coincidentally, this was also the week when the Jimmy Reid Foundation published a highly influential paper by Dr. Jim and Dr. Margaret Cuthbert of Stirling University on the Smith Commission. And it's now clear that the Scotland Bill, taken over from the Smith Commission's findings, is quite clearly a trap for the independence movement. That's the conclusion that the Cuthberts draw in their paper, and it's the conclusion that most analysts have now drawn this week after examining the details of the Scotland Bill, because what we have here is David Cameron's attempt to pass on very, very little extra fiscal powers to the Scottish Parliament, and yet at the same time pass over the political responsibility for making cuts to the budget and to the health and education provision here in Scotland. Because what's at root here is that the Tories, in a cunning way, using the Smith Commission and now the Scotland Bill, have outlined proposals to devolve one aspect of the tax base to Scotland, the income tax rates, and as the Cuthberts have pointed out, this does not include savings income and dividend income. So they passed on a very minor power to set the income tax rates, but the Cuthberts and others have pointed out that what they call the gearing problem means that should Westminster decide to cut interest income tax rates south of the border and then make consequent cuts in reserved areas of spending in order to balance the books, this is a clear trap for the Holyrood Parliament, because in order to follow the same cut in income tax, they would then have to make cuts in devolved areas and devolved expenditure, such as health and education in Scotland and welfare, since some of the welfare powers are to be passed to Holyrood as well. And you can see therein how the political responsibility for cuts has been passed from Westminster to Holyrood, therefore no longer blaming London for things like the bedroom tax or the poll tax or cuts in that way. The political blame would lie at Holyrood. And therefore it's interesting that this week Joyce McMillan, writing in The Scotsman, really condemns the five parties in Scotland for signing up to the Smith Commission way back in October, November this year. And I have to say, I'm beginning to think the Scottish Socialist Party's unique exclusion from the Smith Commission is the only one of the six parties formerly involved in the independence campaign has turned out to be a blessing, because the Scottish Socialist Party hasn't signed up to this trap. And we have to warn now the independence movement that we must not touch the Scotland Bill, we must not sign up, we must not allow the SNP to sign up to what is in effect a neoliberal bias of cutting taxes for the better off and passing on the responsibilities for cuts and political decisions like that to Holyrood. That's the interesting development, and it means that the Scottish National Party at Westminster now face a very stark decision as far as their tactics are concerned in pursuing the independence cause at Westminster. And I believe we saw in First Minister's questions this week where Nicola Sturgeon's full outrage at the powers of the Scottish, the Scotland Bill, in my view, demonstrate the dilemma the SNP has got themselves into. So they signed up to Smith, they presented Smith as progress, and now Smith, renamed as the Scotland Bill, is displayed in all its light as a trap for the independence movement that the Scottish Socialist Party and our allies in that movement must press the SNP to reject. That's the big story of this week's politics in Scotland.
Compromises. I don't care about rebel stances. I don't talk about blank stances. I don't think about lack of substance. I don't need that ersatz rebellion. I still dream of revolution. What I want is, what I need is, I want to hear those, I want to sing those hardy songs. For the limousine liberals, I don't want to be absolved by everything I love. The fecal just inherit shit. Shit, 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 and that's it. I never wanted compromises. I don't care about rebel stances. I don't talk about black stances. I don't think about lack of substance. I don't need that ersatz rebellion. I still dream of revolution.
In 1855, Karl Marx wrote that it is an old and historically established maxim that obsolete social forces, once more summon all their strength before their agony of death, pass from the defensive to the offensive, challenge instead of giving way, and seek to draw the most extreme conclusions from premises which have not only been put in question, but already condemned. That seems to sum up the current state of politics in the UK, and it seems like everywhere else. Citizens deny the standard ruling parties their majorities and elect what were previously fringe parties. They challenge mainstream journalists through social media and find alternative sources of news. And the response of those in the elite? A mixture of contempt and confusion. A government minister lies about having leaked a dodgy memo during an election, and then after the election, and after an inquiry, he reveals that in fact he had leaked it. But he's no longer a minister, and anyway, for the good of democracy, Scotland needs at least one Lib Dem MP. It's not surprising that Alistair Carmichael thinks he should remain as an MP. It's no surprise that Lib Dem Malcolm Bruce agrees, or that The Guardian's Michael White thinks so too. What is surprising is the ham-fisted way they've defended their position. Carmichael says he now regrets his error of judgment. Malcolm Bruce says that, in the heated atmosphere of an election campaign, Carmichael made a mistake, but when asked if lying is rife in public life, he stated that yes, lots of people have told lies, and we'd clear out the Houses of Parliament if we got rid of all the liars. Michael White agrees that liars are everywhere, even among voters who lied to the pollsters, and he stated on Twitter that MPs represent voters, so that includes a few bad MPs to represent a few bad voters. There has been more moral outrage in the media at the SNP collapsing, instead of doing the usual braying in the House of Commons, than Carmichael's lying. But all of this is relatively trivial compared to the real work of politicians. Consider the recent Queen's speech. The Tories were elected by 24% of the electorate, but they will demand that unions balloting for strikes achieve a 50% turnout and that 40% of those voting must back the vote. This, the Queen read, was to reform trade unions and protect essential public services. Families on benefits are to receive £23,000 a year maximum, down from £26,000. The government will control immigration and put hard-working families first by treating the wages of so-called illegal immigrants as if they were the proceeds of crime and seize them. In order to protect British values, Ofcom will be empowered to take action against channels that transmit extremist content, and employers will be able to determine whether someone is an extremist and bar them from working with children. The government will keep us safe by spying on everyone, not only looking at what we do online, but storing huge amounts of information. The Carmichael affair shows clearly how the powerful think and how confused they are by the public's reaction. But the Queen's speech shows no matter how confused our dear leaders are by us, they still plan to, as Marx said, draw the most extreme conclusions from premises which have not only been put into question but already condemned. Despite the fact that neither the Tories nor Labour can command a majority in the House of Commons, they will still insist that they have a mandate no matter how unpopular their policies or whether or not anyone actually asked for them. In the old regime of pre-revolutionary France, the king's mandate came directly from God, and those who opposed the system were denounced as unbelievers. In the long run, the policies of burdening the poor with taxes elites didn't pay and sending the children of the poor to endless wars meant that not everyone accepted the king's mandate. The last-minute attempts to reform the system led to revolution. There's no point in trying to reason with people who are unreasonable. We need to work for an entirely different system and do it in a different way, not making excuses for ourselves and saying, well, everyone does it.
Thank you, Don McKean. Before Don, you heard Entero Bang and Are You Ready, People? These are Dundee's best, the Cundies, and this is Wannabe.
Then the schemes you never help them try the shite. Oh, I don't twist their coin till the end of whatever bear. Find Ray Douglas, my boy, grew up just outside Blair. Wanna be, but they'll never be, cause they can't see them chasing fake identity. Wanna be, but they'll never be, cause they can't see them chasing fake identity. Wanna be, but they'll never be, cause they can't see them chasing fake identity. Wanna be, but they'll never be, cause they can't see them chasing fake identity. Shadow one, the fields will scoff up, but we see through the land rent. The radio seem to change like the new pals, Cat Jones. Back who's back car, back holidays, back debt on living loans. They're living in a dream world, their heads are up their ass. They're obsessed by twat utopia, realms of middle class. As the class that matters, they should get it's what's inside. By empty heads, we land tongues and shoulders, class divide. Wanna be, but they'll never be, cause they can't see them chasing fake identity. Wanna be, but they'll never be, cause they can't see them chasing fake identity. Wanna be, but they'll never be, cause they can't see them chasing fake identity. Wanna be, but they'll never be, cause they can't see them chasing fake identity. What's inside their minds? The good life they'll never find. What's inside their minds? What's inside their minds? What's inside their minds? What's inside their minds? Wanna be, but they'll never be, cause they can't see them chasing fake identity. Wanna be, but they'll never be, cause they can't see them chasing fake identity. Wanna be, but they'll never be, cause they can't see them chasing fake identity. Wanna be, but they'll never be, cause they can't see them chasing fake identity. Job Thompson's barely strength, my worried impression. But I'm none of that the shell and fuck and think there's something better. The fail to see for you and the empty bones that I'm here. Wanna be, but they'll never be, cause they can't see them chasing fake identity. Wanna be, but they'll never be, cause they can't see them chasing fake identity. Wanna be, but they'll never be, cause they can't see them chasing fake identity. Wanna be, but they'll never be, cause they can't see them chasing fake identity.
SNP member in Mulgai, a member I hope one day will be in the same party as me. After Deborah, you'll hear Joe solo, and you've all this to come.
Hello, I'm Deborah Torrance, a member of the SNP branch here in Mulgai. So, there's been a bit of a shake-up since I last spoke to you. A bunch of folk have went down to Westminster to represent us, and most of them have the same coloured ribbon. The Tories got back in, though, and shock, we're facing more cuts. I've been really quite worried about it. I'm disabled myself, and the welfare reforms, I'm doing air quotes here, are nothing but a slice of the sickle across the income of the poorest and most vulnerable in society. Our social security system is meant to be just that, a security. I can tell you from my own experiences, there's nothing secure about our benefit system these days. We need to change this. We need a citizen's income now. I've seen a lot of commentary recently about traditions and etiquette. How are we meant to smash the archaic system of inequality and misogyny if we adhere to their traditions? Again, I'm doing air quotes, but it's quite lost in the podcast, so I'm going to stop it now. I asked, when did this tradition of not clapping begin? Oh, it's to do with the timing of speeches and how it could be used as a protest, like coordinated slow clapping and the like. What? So when did it begin, this banning of applauding in Parliament? Well, apparently William Wilberforce got a standing ovation for bringing about the abolition bill. So if some people say that we should stick to these traditions and respect them, I say, meh. Bring out the vuvuzelas and blow them in the faces of those who aren't respecting the traditions of poor and vulnerable folk. You know, the traditions of eating or having a house over your head, you know, that sort of thing. And I say we need to do it like this so that we can make changes like getting a citizen's income on the go. So I'm banging my drum. Blow your vuvuzelas and applaud your heart out.
Mr. Oh, Mr., I blame all of yous who sat back in silence with too much to lose. You who deafened your ears to the sound of the guns. You've all this to come, you've all this to come. You can bury your heads in the sand for so long and pray when you're dragging back out, they'll have gone off. But by then the damage is already done. You've all this to come, you've all this to come. Mister, you'll soon wipe that look off your face when you're next on their list to ship out of this place. When you can't trust your children, your neighbours all shun you. You've all this to come, you've all this to come. Fear is their weapon and money their bit. You'll be taught how to grovel and primed how to hit till you'll sell your own brother for a place in the sun. You've all this to come, you've all this to come. See how fascism works, Mr. Stroh. The collective self-interest of people like you who would crawl up their mountain to slay your own son. You've all this to come, you've all this to come. And when their bombers rain fire from the sky and your people are dying, you'll wanna know why. And it's cause you didn't do now what had to be done. You've all this to come, you've all this to come. Mister, oh mister, I blame all of yous. Sat back in silence with too much to lose.
Hi Alan, how's it going?
Hi, good thanks Michael, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad. I was trying to get you for an interview before the independence referendum, and at that point you were a member of another party, but you've changed over. Why did you decide to do that?
That's right, yeah. I was a member of the Labour Party for most of my life, a supporter for nearly all of my life from very early age. And, you know, the referendum, it was a tough 2 years with the constant leadership against, you know, what Labour for Independence was trying to do, which was to open up an avenue for Labour supporters and Labour members to come out in support of a yes vote and see it as a restoration of what the Labour Party could be and what it was once was. And we felt that the yes vote in the referendum was the last chance to save the soul of the Labour Party and save it from its own destruction. And you don't want to say, I told you so, but after that last election, it looked pretty close. I mean, I personally just felt that the referendum was the last straw. There was a few things near the end. Seeing Jim Murphy hugging Annabel Goldie and Clyde Bank, of all places, or watching Joanne Lamont smiling outside of Asda's at the news that prices would be going up for working class people for their food and their shopping in an independent Scotland. I just found very distasteful, and it's not something that, you know, people like Keir Hardie and John Smith and Nye Bevan would ever have wanted to be associated with, and it wasn't really something that I wanted to be associated with as well. I think if there had been a yes vote, I would have stayed and fought for the party to try and bring it back. I think that was the end. Yeah, it took some time to think about it. Spoke to a few people, spoke to Colin Fox, told me what the plans were for the Scottish Socialist Party and how they wanted to move forward after such a successful referendum. Was very impressed with the party as a whole, campaigning with them during the referendum. Very impressed with people like Colin, like Richie Venton and Sandra Webster, who I spoke with throughout the campaign. And yeah, I was sold pretty quickly, I think. Yeah.
Having read some of the things you wrote in the run-up to the referendum and seen some of the things that you were speaking at, I never had you pegged as a natural ally of Jim Murphy.
Jim Murphy to me is the antithesis of what the Labour Party is supposed to be about. Jim Murphy is the very reason why Labour's in the position it's in. He's symbolic of how far right and how progress became like a cancer into the Labour Party and sucked all the socialism out of the leadership. And you know, it's a sad state of affairs, and it was bittersweet watching that election. It was good to see people like Jim Murphy get their just cause, just desserts. But, you know, a bit of sadness as well that people like Katie Clark, who was a good Member of Parliament and was a good constituency MP, lost her seat because of what had happened to the Labour Party.
So that brings us to the bones of what we're going to talk about tonight, which is what now for the left in Scotland, because we've got various strands going in different directions here. You know, the SNP are certainly to the left of Labour, and Scotland voted for the thing that's most likely to win on the left, as usual, and gets the right, as usual. Although I don't think anyone could describe the SNP as a socialist party. They would describe themselves as social democratic. Labour seems to be intent on going more Blairite again, and the SSP is a little bit on the rise. And we've also had talk of a new Scottish Syriza, the Scottish Left Project. So there's a number of irons in the fire, and there's a number of things going on here. How do you make any sense of what's going on here?
I mean, I think if you look at the general election results, you'll see that there's a seismic change has obviously happened in Scotland, and part of it's due to the referendum. I think a lot of that came about because of the Labour voters who came out and supported a yes vote. And, you know, again, it's almost like we predicted would happen. When Labour for Independence started, I think it was at 9%, the Labour vote for yes, and by the end it was something like 39%. It was almost half. And this 40% of people were demonised by their own political party. They were called traitors. And then you turn around and want to expect you to vote for them. It's ridiculous. That being said, you're absolutely right. The SNP are certainly not a socialist party or anything close to that. To be to the left of Labour doesn't make you a left-wing party. That's like saying Nigel Farage is a nicer guy than Hitler, you know? He's still Nigel Farage, and UKIP are still a racist party. But I mean, I think that there is a lot of changes that's happening, and I am concerned that the monopoly within the SNP has now in Scotland can be dangerous, because we saw that through history with the Labour Party in the 70s and 80s, even the 90s. You know, put a red rosette on them, and they would win in most places. Such was their dominance, and that's a concern. And now you're going to see that same thing with the SNP. And when you get to situations like that, then the elector, those who are elected, tend to be less responsive to the needs of the voters, those who elected them, and more to the needs of their own selves and those who can benefit them in other ways. And so that's a concern for me. And so I think it's very important that when there is an opposition, in order to remain and retain a progressive politics in Scotland, then that opposition needs to come from the left.
Even people in the SNP, not necessarily MSPs or some of the people at the top end of it, but even members of the SNP who were going to stand, Leslie Riddick said it recently, have been commenting that Scotland does need a strong opposition. And at the moment, Labour, as currently constituted, doesn't seem like they're going to provide it. The Tories aren't going to provide it. Liberals are gone. So this new opposition has to come from the left.
Absolutely, yeah. I think it does. And I think it's important for the way we progress as politics that it does come from the left. We don't want to see a resurgence of a Conservative Party, because, you know, people who are perhaps a little bit older than myself, well, quite a bit older than myself, remember the Conservative majority in Scotland in the 1950s. So it hasn't been that long ago, and we don't want to see a resurgence coming from the right. And I think it's very important for Scotland to maintain that progressive politics we've had for the last 20, 30 years, that continues to come from the left, in whatever guise that may be. You mentioned the Scottish Left Project, and at a conference this week, we as a party, the SSP, voted to begin negotiations. And I want to stress that it's the beginning of negotiations. It's not a done deal or a formalised deal. It will be negotiations to see whether it will be an electoral alliance. But for me, when I joined the SSP, I spoke at the first conference, and I said to the members that I didn't join the party to sit on the political fringes fighting over 4% of the vote. I joined because I wanted to see the Scottish Socialist Party in there as the main opposition to the SNP, and eventually overtaking that and becoming the party of government in Scotland. And I think that's an achievable aim. It's not an aim that can happen overnight, and it will take a lot of hard work and it will take time. But I think we're moving in the right direction. We're starting to get new members who are very active, very passionate, and it's great to see some of the enthusiasm and ideas that are coming out, like the march, the demonstrations all over Scotland tomorrow. This is Wednesday. It's happening on against Tory rule, the denying the Tory dictatorship. And I think, you know, these movements will start to recapture the imagination of the working class people in Scotland, and will get the Scottish Socialist Party back into their minds when they come to the ballot box, and hopefully put their cross beside our party.
And certainly with a proportional representation system in the Scottish Parliament, things are much more likely to work out better for the SSP in the short term.
No, I think you're right. I mean, we had four candidates in the general election and we got less than 1% of the share of the vote. It's not the political party that's going to win the first-past-the-post system at this current moment in time. But that being said, I think you're right, in proportional representation, we have a real opportunity. And I think it will be for a lot of people who support the independence movement. There are a lot of people who are socialists, even those who 40 or 50,000 socialists who joined a social democratic party rather than a socialist party, which they could have done. I think that the choice for them is between the Greens and the SSP, or if there is a electoral alliance between whatever form it may take, with the Scottish Left Project and the SSP or whatever guys. But I think there's choices to make, and I think those second votes are certainly up for grabs for the smaller political parties who supported the referendum, who supported the yes.
And I think this idea that you've mentioned of an electoral alliance, let's speculate for a moment about how that would work. So I'm just thinking, who might be involved in that? So the Greens, the SSP, the Commonweal, maybe they've speculated some ideas about this. So was there any discussions about how this would work?
It's a very good question. I'm wondering how it's going to work myself as well. I'll be honest, at conference I was against the discussions, and I've made no bones about that, and it's there for all to see. I think it would be better for us to spend this time to rebuild our party, and any moment spent on rebuilding the Left Project is moments that are spent, much needed moments spent, apart from building the political party that we need to be to become the opposition in Scotland. However, you know, I go with the will of the party, and the membership voted for it, and I will support it now during the negotiations. I'll support our negotiating team to get the best deal for Scottish Socialist Party and the people of Scotland as well, and give them a real alternative to vote for rather than the SNP or the other major political parties. I don't see the Green Party taking part in it. I think they're quite content to continue to campaign as their own party. And you know, there's questions about who else actually is there, except for some of the leading members in the Radical Independence Campaign and the Scottish Socialist Party. And if that's the case, then obviously the Scottish Socialist Party will be the main bloc of that alliance by quite a large bit. I think there's so many unanswered questions. And for me, that was the reason why I was against it, because I think time is of the essence. However, I put my trust in the negotiating team, and I'm completely confident that we will decide what's best for the party and for the electoral alliance, that if there is one, and if there isn't one, then we'll provide the alternative, which is voting for the Scottish Socialist Party.
So how could this work in the situation where, this is a more general question, but how could this work in the situation where the SSP will continue not to get much coverage in the media, but they do have an increasing number of activists?
You know, it's one of those catch-22. You need the media to get more members, you need more members to get the media. And I think we have managed to achieve that in the referendum, the fact that over 2,500 people applied to join the Scottish Socialist Party. And I think, you know, the new members that have come in have made giant strides and great ideas. But it's always been an issue for the left wing in Scotland, because, you know, socialists generally tend not to get a lot of coverage by the media unless it's for negative reasons. And I think what we have to do is to try and rebuild the party. Lots of things we can do in terms of marketing, rebuilding. I think, and I'll continue to call for this, but I think we should say that we are the party for the people who I deemed the real Labour voters during the referendum, those traditional Labour voters who feel abandoned by the party. You know, the Jimmy Reid line that they didn't leave the Labour Party, the Labour Party left them. Some have joined the SNP, but I can imagine most of them who have done will probably eventually feel quite uncomfortable being in that position when they realise that they're not in a socialist party either, and certainly a party that takes most of their finances, or a great deal of their finances, from someone like Brian Suter. I don't think can ever claim to be entirely for equality or socialist either.
No, no, and the reason I asked you that, though, was because you come from a Labour background, and maybe you would dispute this. I've always felt that basically BBC Scotland is BBC Scotland Labour, or BBC Scottish Labour. I mean, the connections between, maybe not with the activists, but the connections between the hierarchy of Labour in Scotland and BBC Scotland are very, very clear to see. So for a long time, Labour in Scotland, or the branch office, or whatever you want to call it, have actually had the BBC on their side. It seems very obvious to me that that's always been the case.
I think you have a point, but I look back and think back to, you know, the BBC in general, and I always felt that they were very more centred towards the Conservatives, particularly when we watch Question Time. You're always...
There's a definite difference between the UK level and the Scottish level.
No, I think, I was just coming to that, I think you're right in terms of in Scotland, there's certainly strong ties between BBC Scotland and the Labour Party, and it's very difficult to break that monopoly unless you were to have a complete overhaul of the BBC, BBC Scotland. But these are going to be in the long term, you know, in terms of once we get independence, then we can look at that. Or perhaps with more powers, we can then look at gaining broadcasting power for the Scottish Parliament. But I think those are all important questions that we can see in the future. And, you know, our concern is about building the Scottish Socialist Party and building up so that we are going to attract interest. And we have been doing so locally. I mean, my branch in Dundee, we've campaigned very hard with lots of other locals in Meenis Hill. In the Save the Municipal High School campaign, we're throwing our weight behind the Save the Porters strike in Nine Wells Hospital. And we're looking at very other local issues, as well as our Scottish Socialist Party national campaigns of, like I mentioned, the demonstration against defying Tory dictatorships and ending austerity and the £10 an hour living wage. And we're going to continue to do that. And, you know, I'm always of the opinion if you shout loud enough, eventually some people are going to have to start turning around and noticing. And I think that's what we have to do. And we have to embrace what we are and move away from the fringes of Scottish politics and actually come out and try and attract these real Labour voters, because these are the voters that are going to vote for us and that can vote for us and could see us becoming the major party of opposition.
And the way that the Conservatives are going to behave in the next few years is obviously going to help this position, because they're going to punish the poor more. It's going to be so severe that people will understand that, quite frankly, there is another alternative. It's not as Thatcher said that there is no alternative. You know, quite frankly, the cruelty that they're going to come out with in the next few years is going to push people into more radical positions, I think.
No, I think you're right. I think when I mentioned at the start of this, talking about that bittersweet night watching the general election results, I think what was even more bittersweet about it was after seeing the Jim Murphys, and even after seeing this, the then waking up in the morning and realising you have another 5 years of a Tory government, and not just that, but you have 5 years of a Tory government without that buffer of, you know, no matter how little impact they did, I think they probably did have a slight impact on making sure that the Tories weren't as savage and severe as they're probably going to be over the next 5 years. And you're absolutely right. More cuts are going to happen, and more people are going to be poorer, more people are going to struggle to pay their rent or put food on the table for the kids, heat their homes. It's what we need to do is offer real alternatives. And what we need to do as well is to support them, to make sure that if they're on benefits or if they're getting their benefits sanctioned, then we can help them with that. We can provide those facilities for them, that we support food banks to make sure that people, although we don't think they have any place in a civilised society, they are essential, because right now we are not living in a civilised society thanks to the Conservative government. And what we need to do is offer the alternatives. So we mentioned fuel poverty. Now looking in the SSP is an energy policy over the next 20 years that would radically transform our energy mix, moving away from fossil fuels and nuclear into using this next 20 years as a transitional period into renewable energies and moving forward in that regard, and thus ending fuel poverty as quickly as possible.
Absolutely, and you should always finish on a high note. So I understand it was bittersweet for you because you know some people within the Labour Party that lost their seat who maybe were good people and were trying to do the right thing, but... Were you happy to see Ian Davidson lose his seat? I was enormously happy, because I believe that he wanted people like you and me bayoneted.
Yeah, I mean, I did enjoy the interview afterwards that he gave about Jim Murphy. I think the one thing about Ian Davidson is that his tongue, his razor-sharp tongue, is two-sided. Interestingly, the story, Dennis Cavan is telling the story that one of the heads, presidents, I think it was, of the NUS at the time, was campaigning to get the student grants, not the student loans, the student grants up to the rate of inflation, and was holding a strike and threatening strike action. And the rate of inflation at this time in the 1970s was something like 35%. And that man was Ian Davidson, who was one of the key proponents of, you know, supporting the student fees. So it just shows you what a peerage or an entry into the Houses of Parliament can do for you. So I hope that's a warning to those 56 SNP MPs as well. Be on your guard. But yeah, I think there were a few that I quite enjoyed. Margaret Curran was a nice one, and yeah, I think Jim Murphy for me was the best. Jim Murphy was what I stayed up for. When he lost, I went to bed.
All right. I enjoyed Ian Davidson personally, but there you go.
So many issues.
There was an interesting thing you mentioned there, because with these 56 SNP MPs going down to London, you're saying you hope they don't, you know, become part of the establishment. One thing I think might stop that from happening is simply that part of the SNP's reason for being there is to get Scotland out of there. So I think there might be less of a possibility that they begin to become acclimatized to that place and start to, you know, become part of it. I think the fact that their reason for being is getting us out of it might mitigate that a wee bit.
I mean, you know, you could be right, and I certainly hope you're right, and I think you even might be right. But I think when we're saying that, what's important to remember that there were men and women from working class backgrounds with a red Labour Party a membership card who went down to try and end capitalism and end the rich taking all the money and leaving nothing for the poor. And, you know, like as I said, Ian Davidson was certainly a proponent for high student grants, never mind charging for tuition. So, you know, I think you're right. I think it's a fair point. And I certainly wouldn't label anything or label anybody with that possibility that could happen. I think it's a danger. I think John McCallion wrote about it in the Socialist Voice very well, because he's obviously got great experience from going down there. And you do have your eyes opened a little bit, I think, when you go down there, and you maybe see some things different that you perhaps didn't imagine could come into your life. But, you know, I hope that they will remember why they were elected and why the people of Scotland elected them. And if they don't, then, as we've seen, the people of Scotland will remind you very quickly at the ballot box.
Indeed. Or you could end up like Dennis Skinner and arguing about your seat.
That's been this for a long time.
All right, thanks very much for talking to us, Alan. Thank you.
Pleasure, Michael. Thanks.
From the toll paddle Mars to Brian and May, from the Liverpool docks to the workers at BA, since the general strike, the workers say, not a penny off the pay, not a second on the day. History tells us to fight. Sometimes you need to stand up for your rights. It's time to break the law, take on the bastards that change clause 4. It's time to break the law. Your right to strike is worth fighting for. Worth fighting for. They had to break the law, George Lovelace and his mates. Lansbury knew the rules when he refused to pay the rates. It was principle and justice, not the laws of our time, that caused the dockers not to cross the picket line. History tells us we must stand up and be counted when we know that it's just. It's time to break the law, take on the bastards that change clause 4. It's time to break the law. Your right to strike is worth fighting for. Worth fighting for. Margaret Thatcher took our rights away, but in 1997 nothing really changed. We didn't know you, Labour, would choose to ignore the history of the movement, George Bernard Shaw. History will call us fools if we elect to play by the rules. It's time to break the law, take on the bastards that change clause 4. It's time to break the law. The right to strike is worth fighting for. Worth fighting for. Worth fighting for.
The Great Reform Act of 1832 was a substantial step forwards for parliamentary democracy in the British Isles, but it left much to be desired for. We saw last time how the Acts would go on to take many of the working and lower middle classes, the very people who had propelled it forwards, and exclude them from the reforms it offered. The response? Well, in 1838 a new document was drawn up, a statement of democratic intent that would shape the next 10 years of political action in Scotland, England and a great many British colonies the world over, before leaving a legacy that would shape both Scottish and English politics right down to the present day. This was the People's Charter. I'm Callum Martin of Edinburgh South and Midlothian SSP, and welcome to Making the Flag Red, a series looking at democracy and struggle for history. This week we're taking a look at Chartism from around 1838 until about 1848. Now, the Charter was written in 1838 and was launched at a series of mass meetings across Scotland and England. Its demands were radically progressive and marked a significant change compared to events in 1832. In 1832, the pressure had been for the Whigs to offer reform. This time the working classes and the lower middle classes would actually present the establishment not just with pressure for reform, but with a specific set of demands. A statement of policies, a manifesto of demands around which forces of progress could rally. It was centred around six core demands. The first, that all men should have a vote, universal male suffrage. The second, that voting should take place by secret ballot. The third, that parliamentary elections should take place every year, not once every 5 years. The fourth, the constituency should all be of roughly equal size in terms of population. Number the fifth, that members of parliament should be paid, which ties in crucially with number six, the property qualification for becoming a member of parliament should be abolished. Now, in an age of parliamentary corruption and expenses scandals, these last two may sound a bit out of keeping with what we talk about now, but they're very much not. But the point was that before this point, in order to become an MP, you had to have, well, legally you had to have a certain amount of money, but you had to be able to pay your own way for 5 years. And the idea behind Chartist fifth and sixth demands was to open up Parliament to the working classes, to the lower middle classes, to people who weren't aristocrats or of incredibly wealthy background anyway. But anyway, so that was the charter. But who were the Chartists? For one thing, are we looking at a Chartist movement in Scotland and a Chartist movement in England and Wales? Or are we looking at a Scottish Chartist movement and an English and Welsh Chartist movement functioning in tandem? This is a question which has been debated in past, and there is a strong argument that says that the latter is perhaps the more accurate description on balance, though with a major caveat. There have been argued to be noteworthy social, political and religious differences between the composition of each movement, and this is reflected into the nature of each movement and some of the content within it. In Scotland, for example, the Chartists tied strongly into quite a different set of pre-existing political and religious movements. There's much talk today of the role of the social movement in helping to underpin political causes, and for the Chartists this was very much the same. The movement against lay patronage, we'll come back to look at this in greater detail another week, in the Church of Scotland in this period was as strong as ever, but Westminster was still refusing to budge, and thus continued to clamp down on the religious freedoms of the people of Scotland. Now, to try to get around this, many people had left the main body of the Kirk, often with a combination of strong evangelicalism and a certain degree of anti-establishment feeling. Now, in Scotland, the presence of this layer in society would lead to the development of the Chartist churches in Scotland, in some sense providing quite a strong social network for Chartism to function upon in Scotland. Now, such Chartist churches were present too in England, but where in Scotland the Chartist churches were closer in core theology to the Presbyterian religious mainstream of the day, in many instances the English and Welsh Chartists tend to be more closely tied to social movements based around minority religious groups such as Baptists and Methodists, who were further removed from the Anglican religious mainstream in England of the day than was the case in Scotland. And it's been suggested sometimes that this, whilst it helped tie down strong Chartist communities in many parts of England and Wales, it left the Chartist churches in England as a whole in a sort of weaker, or patchier, or more regional-based social situation. So this obviously raises questions about the nature of the social movement in Scotland compared to England and Wales. I mean, the question should be asked, did the nature of, sort of underlying religious dissent in England and Wales and in Scotland in contrast, did this lead to a slightly more patchy or more regionalist social movement in England than Scotland? Well, there's a case for it, but it is hard to say for certain, and debate is still ongoing. But suffice to say, we can see there a very clear distinction in terms of the social movements, or the nature of religious social movements around which each was based. Now, another element, which is that both would make very strong use of history and traditional national symbols of revolt and protest to build up cohesive national movements, which would set much of the social iconography that was used in opposition to ideas of a single British sort of movement, if that makes sense. Figures such as William Wallace were seen, who was presented as a man of humble origins, leading the humble people of Scotland to overturn the knightly and oppressive army of the kings of England in the name of liberty. In Scotland, William Wallace was this presentation of William Wallace, at least, was a central national figure, a national icon of the Chartists. Though clearly, such a figure would not, you know, naturally extend itself into the English equivalent. The English had their own heroes of legend and history, so we can see then that there's a very different, you know, there's a different style of national expression attached to these two movements. So, suffice to say then, were they two separate movements or were they one? Well, there's a clear case to suggest there was probably two distinctive movements, but that caveat we mentioned, the caveat was that even if there were two separate, a Scottish and English were two more movements, they were functioning, perhaps for the first time, in very, very tight tandem. This was the first time the Scottish and English reform movements were functioning as one, even if they were separate, rather than just going off entirely in their own directions. The Charter was thus able to provide a key statement, a manifesto, around which all could rally, be they in Scotland or in England. Yeah. And rally they did. The women's suffrage movement, the Scottish disestablishmentarianist movements, the forerunners of the trade union movements in the coal mining areas of South Wales and Northern England, Democrats, evangelical progressives, radicals and all manner of reformers and revolutionaries would eventually be brought together under the banner of the Chartists. Now, between 1838 and 1839, the Chartists had been busy. The Chartists managed to present a petition to Westminster with some 1.25 million subscribers by June of 1839. Parliament simply refused to accept it, however, and turned to force to crush any dissent. Take, for example, the Newport Rising in November of 1839. In the South Welsh town of Newport, leading Chartists had been arrested by the authorities, and in an attempt to free them, between 1,000 and 5,000 coal miners and Chartists took up arms and attempted to march in the building where the arrested leaders were being held. In the event, a firefight broke out between the army and the Chartists, and the rising was quickly dissipated. The leaders of it were sentenced to transportation for life and swiftly removed from British shores. Now, this was not the end of the Chartist movement. In 1842, a second petition was presented, this time with over 3 million signatures from across the British Isles. But again, the result was the same. Parliament rejected it and turned to brute force to quell the ensuing unrest. Now, combined with a major economic depression bringing wages down, strikes actually broke out across, I think it's an estimated 14 English and 8 Scottish counties, especially focused around, in England, the Midlands, Lancashire, Cheshire, Yorkshire, and in Scotland, the central belt, especially around the western end. Now, in 1848, a third petition would be presented. This time, the rejection of the petition would be final. Parliament rejected the petition, and with the army on hand, the unrest which had arisen in 1838 and 1842 really sort of fizzles out before it can even begin. Now, the Chartist movement began to actually wind away and dissipate after the failure of the 1848 petition. Splits and divisions over tactics and the exact nature of demands began to emerge. But this was only one, you know, element of the demise of a Chartist movement per se. The forces involved in the Chartist movement, for example, were clearly not finished. But what had happened is that as time had moved by, elements within the Whigs, who through this period began the process of becoming the Liberals, began to accept elements of the Chartist demands and piece by piece were brought to enact them, whilst others from within the Chartist movement began to look for more and more radical demands, more and more radical tactics. So electoral reform and the movement for it absolutely did continue. By 1918, a mere 80 years after the Charter was written, some might say, all but one of the demands of the Charter would be met, that for annual elections. And indeed, the Charter too had an impact not just on the development of events in Scotland and England, but on British colonies as well. Take, for example, the revolt of Australian reformers and gold miners at the Battle of the Eureka Stockade in the 1850s, a key step towards the parliamentary reform in Australia. Back in Europe, however, it was 1848 in which the Chartist movement really wound away. But 1848 would prove a watershed of a year, a year which would give rise to events which would redraw the political, national and economic map of Europe by the time they had played out. We'll come back to look at those in much greater detail over the next couple of weeks. Until then though, I've been Callum Martin. Thanks for listening.
Thanks Callum, and thanks to Michael Greenwell, whose podcast is another one to look up. And you'll find it at www.spreaker.com/user/Michael Greenwell, all one word. The previous track was Steve White and the Protest Family, Right to Strike, which goes out to the homeless case workers who are on strike in Glasgow for the 10th week. They deserve your support. There is a Facebook page, www.facebook.com/Glasgow Homeless Case Workers Strike. I have a few events to tell you about, a few SSP events and another event as well. On Thursday the 4th, from 7 o'clock in the Thistle Bar in Alloa, Clack's SSP relaunch. Come along for an informal chat and a discussion about where the Scottish Socialist Party are heading. There's going to be an emphasis on launching our 2016 Scottish Parliament election campaign. There'll be a couple of good speakers, some raffle prizes, and of course there is the bar. And also there's going to be an SSP quiz night in the Wash Bar in Edinburgh at 7 o'clock on Sunday the 7th. Brush up on your general knowledge and get ready for another SSP pub quiz. Our new venue is the Wash Bar on the Mound. Entry is £5. Joe Solo, who you heard earlier, is organising a brilliant weekend of music in solidarity against the cuts in October. It's going to be called the We Shall Overcome Weekend. Please go to the Facebook page for the event. That's www.facebook.com/We Shall Overcome Weekend. For more details, I'll certainly give out more details of what promises to be an amazing weekend of music throughout the UK in October. And until next time, we leave you with Thief Action, one of my favourite socialist bands. They'll be playing on Saturday the 27th of June on the Left Field stage at Glastonbury. This is one band well worth the weekend ticket price alone. This is Mark's My Main Man.
but one book got the answers in. Come and read it, don't be shy. You can get it from the library. Mark's my main man, it's a mighty manifesto. Mark's my main man, it's a pocket full of joy. Mark's my main man, it's got all the angles covered. That angle's got it covered too. Financial emancipation in a world where all are free. It fills my heart with love and affection. Baby, join the family. Mark's my main man, it's a mighty manifesto. Mark's my main man, it's a pocket full of joy. Mark's my main man, it's got all the angles covered. That angle's got it covered too. Mark's my main man, it's a pocket full of joy. Mark's my main man, it's got all the angles covered. And angles got it covered too. Say hello with me children now. Mark's my main man, it's a mighty manifesto. Mark's my main man, it's a pocket full of joy. Mark's my main man, it's got all the angles covered. Angles got it covered too. Yeah, Mark's my main man, it's a mighty manifesto. Mark's my main man, it's a pocket full of joy. Mark's my main man, it's got all the angles covered. And angles got it covered too. Mark's my main man, it's a mighty manifesto. Mark's my main man, it's a pocket full of joy. Mark's my main man, it's got all the angles covered. And angles got it covered too. Mark's my main man, it's a mighty manifesto. Mark's my main man, it's a bucket full of joy. Mark's my main man, it's got all the angles covered. And angles got it covered too.